The full risk to homes, infrastructure and beaches right around Port Phillip Bay from sea level rise and storm surges linked to climate change has been revealed in confidential government studies that lay bare the multi-billion dollar challenges facing bayside communities and the environment.
That's the opening for a story from the Melbourne Age by Royce Miller and Benjamin Priest. It has the headline, "The Suburbs Most Under Threat from Rising Seas Revealed." And this is the latest episode of Climate Conversations, and I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Now let's hear the rest of that story from the Melbourne Age.
Almost 6 years after the government commissioned work on its Port Phillip Bay coastal hazard assessment, it has finally released research mapping out the likely impacts on the 310-kilometre shoreline. It warns the effect of the higher sea level would be amplified by stronger tides, bigger waves and changes in the level of groundwater. That combination of events would fuel a tenfold increase in inundation, with almost 5 square kilometres in central Melbourne, including in Docklands, Southbank and Fisherman's Bend, at risk in a scenario of sea level rise of 1.4 metres by 2100 and during a 1 in 100 chance event. Selected Bayside Council heads and others were briefed on the study's general findings on Tuesday, the day the government released key documents to the Age through Freedom of Information, FOI, including commercial in-confidence research by the CSIRO that was commissioned in 2019 and completed in 2022. The hazard studied included the impacts of sea level rise, inundation, erosion and rising groundwater levels, factoring in storm surges and wave height, in the most comprehensive analysis to date of the risk of climate change to communities, assets and the natural environment around the bay, including Geelong. Victoria's precious coastline is already being impacted by climate change. Our focus is on managing the risks, adapting to the changes, and supporting communities and industries to be resilient, Environment Minister Steve Dimopoulos said in a statement. The findings provide the basis for potentially controversial and politically sensitive inundation overlays to guide development, but also discussions about what infrastructure, and possibly housing, may need to be abandoned or relocated. Areas identified as especially vulnerable include Point Lonsdale, Queenscliff and Port Arlington to the southwest of the bay, Werribee and Altona to the northwest, South Bank, Port Melbourne and Elwood in the north, and Mordialloc, Patterson Lakes and Martha Cove to the south and southeast. In its final report for the government, the CSIRO notes that the most extensive hazard zones are in low-lying parts of the western side of the bay, including around Point Henry, Point Lilias, the strip between Little River and the Werribee River, and further north along the Altona and Williamstown foreshores. But more sensitive, including politically, is the area to the east and south where there are expensive homes in swinging seats. The CSIRO report says rising sea levels will likely reduce the effectiveness of existing, aging structures that have artificially modified the coastline since European settlement, such as seawalls, marinas and beach renourishment, trucking in sand. It also warns that while the narrow entrance to the bay, through the heads, has restricted tidal flows, rising seas will reduce that effect, amplifying the impact of sea level rise. While the City of Melbourne has limited coastline and significant protective structures, such as seawalls, the CSIRO found that at sea level rise of 1.4 metres by 2100, the effectiveness of seawalls would be reduced. The area at risk of inundation in a 1 in a 100 chance event would expand tenfold to take in almost 5 square kilometres of the central city, including through South Bank and Fisherman's Bend. In the city of Port Phillip, the area at risk would increase almost fivefold to about 7 square kilometres. Further south, the inundation hazard increased tenfold to 4.4 square kilometres. Much of the increase would be around the Edith Vale Seaford wetlands between Mordialloc Creek and Patterson River, with the CSIRO concluding that at 1.4 metres sea level rise, existing coastal protective structures would not be effective. On the Mornington Peninsula, inundation at 1.4 metres sea level rise would centre on Martha Cove and along the foreshore from Rosebud to Dramana. The CSIRO report notes that the primary hazard faced by coastal communities worldwide is sea level rise. The level at which it is forecast is crucial to the assessment of the hazard. The state government has not updated its planning benchmark for sea level rise since 2008, when it first incorporated the then upper end projections of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, for at least a 0.8 metres sea level rise by 2100. But since then, researchers have found the Victorian coast is also being pounded by waves from a more southerly direction and of increasing height, especially during storms. In 2019, the IPCC revised its projections, factoring in ice melt, and found that inaction on climate change would likely result in sea level rise of 1.1 metres by 2100. It continues to update its projections. Several other states are already planning for larger increases in sea levels. New South Wales is anticipating increases of up to 1.06 metres based on IPCC data and depending on action to limit greenhouse gas emissions. South Australia is planning for an increase of 1 metre. The Port Phillip project modelled sea level rise across a range of forecasts from 0.8 to 1.4 metres. A well-placed source, speaking anonymously to discuss confidential information, said the government was preparing to update its sea level rise forecasts in line with IPCC's in the first half of this year. Dimopoulos said the Port Phillip hazard assessment work would be used to help councils and communities better understand, plan for, and manage the increasing impacts of climate change on our coastal environments. University of Melbourne geomorphologist Professor David Kennedy said councils should not be left with the expensive and politically fraught task of turning the research into planning rules. For something of this critical importance, at a minimum, planning at state level is needed to provide the guidelines from which local planners can assess future development proposals, he said. In an ideal world, this should be undertaken at a federal level. The issue of climate change does not stop at state boundaries or local boundaries. The Port Phillip work follows the release of a related study last year by University of Melbourne Professor of Environmental Economics Tom Kompas, who has described sea level rise as the biggest risk to the Australian economy from climate change, above bushfires, heat stress and the damage to agriculture. Kompas found that Victoria faced property damages reaching $337 billion in present value by 2100, with more than 80,000 current residential, commercial and industrial properties likely affected by sea level rises and storm surges by 2100. The losses to wetlands would reach a further $105 billion over the same period, bringing the total to $442 billion.
Yes, the first step is really simple. Declare a climate emergency. After that, things get a bit more complex. However, listen to this op-ed from Colin Hughes, which you'll find on Michael West Media. The headline for the story is, Declare a climate emergency or face catastrophic rising temperatures and sea levels.
World governments must declare a climate emergency if they are serious about science and the catastrophic effects of rising temperatures and sea levels. All governments have to do to address the climate and ecological emergency is just to acknowledge it is the most significant threat facing humanity and agree to take immediate action to address and avert the emergency. Stephen Barlow, conservationist and environmentalist. Last year saw the world's global heating reach 1.5 degrees, 27 years before the IPCC target of zero by 2050 to hold global heating to 1.5 degrees. Global sea temperatures have been at record highs of over 0.5 degrees above baseline for over 289 days. The greatest loss of sea ice is in the West Antarctic ice shelf and the Arctic pole ice, which if it continues at this pace could cause sea level rises of up to 4 meters over hundreds of years. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, concluded in a 2022 report, even on the pathway with the lowest possible greenhouse gas emissions and warming, 1.5 degrees Celsius, global mean sea level would rise at least 0.3 meters, 1 foot, above 2000 levels by 2100. According to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Catherine Mersman, global sea level rise is accelerating incrementally over time rather than increasing at a steady rate, as previously thought, according to a 2018 study based on 25 years of NASA and European satellite data. If the rate of ocean rise continues to change at this pace, sea level will rise 26 inches, 65 centimeters, by 2100, enough to cause significant problems for coastal cities. This threatens the collapse of the Atlantic Meridional, overturning current AMOC as early as the next few years, with devastating effects on the Gulf Stream and resultant weather patterns. The food chain. The world has lost 40% of its insects, threatening pollination and the collapse of its food systems. Coral reefs, including our precious Ningaloo and Great Barrier Reefs, face collapse when global heating reaches 2 degrees, threatening fish supplies. In Australia, we are seeing unprecedented floods and earlier bushfire seasons. Australia has lost 100 km of kelp forests along our coastlines. Our fragile mountain ash, Karri and Jarrah forests are at threat from loss of groundwater runoff due to declining rainfall. At least 23 marsupials, including the iconic koala, are facing imminent extinction, as well as over 2,000 plants and invertebrates. So it really is that simple. Declare a climate emergency, like they did for COVID or what they do in war, and divert all action to this end. Every decision that government makes must then be put through the prism of its effect on global heating and its mitigation. But for the politics, it is crystal clear what the obstacles are, but procrastination for the past 50 years has kicked the can down the road, so that now only the most radical action can avert disaster for future generations. Half a megaton of emissions will still be present in 80 years, still accelerating global heating as more and more tipping points are reached. The answer is simple. The crisis is being driven by the mindless pursuit of economic growth on a finite planet. All of our leadership, industry, finance and governments are utterly wedded to and fixated on economic growth with no regard for the ecological costs. So these elites refuse to declare the climate emergency because it would mean in so many ways, halting or changing in some way the economic growth agenda. Those at the top of decision-making in society are part of the 1% of the richest people in society, where they all lead extravagant lifestyles with massive carbon emissions. The top 1% account for more carbon emissions than the poorest 66%. What is less understood that in Australia this actually represents over 580,000 Australians, or 3.8% of taxpayers. The biggest driver of these emissions are in our superannuation funds, which hold 50% of all fossil fuel investments, all tax-free on retirement, and whose companies pay little or no tax on what belongs to we, the people of Australia. In their ecocidal pursuit of this economic growth to preserve and enhance their lifestyles is pure self-interest, because their wealth, power, status and luxury lifestyles depend on it. Just like the smoker who knows that smoking will ultimately kill them, the cognitive dissonance of our leaders is unconscionable. They know the consequences, they have read the science and IPCC reports, but deep in their psyche they believe their wealth will protect them and their families. Ecosystem threatened by economic system. So this tiny demographic can simply block action by doing nothing, refuse to agree to the urgency of action, deliberately dissembling, lying through their massive budgets and false advertising in the media, and the more insidious state capture of our politicians, demanding laws against peaceful, non-violent protesters and lucrative board positions on retirement. It is clear net zero by 2050 is unachievable, not because it would fail to address the crisis, but we are also facing a biodiversity crisis which is equally important as the climate crisis and will lead to ecological collapse, mass starvation and the deaths of 1 billion people and billions more climate refugees through loss of agriculture and fresh water. We either solve both or we solve neither. This is a systemic problem, caused by the whole of the current economic system, imposed by government under the control of the economic elites. Only whole of system change to a degrowth, sustainable, circular economy with zero population growth that puts equal emphasis on ecological sustainability can we possibly achieve halting rising emissions.
Now we have three 90-second segments from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. For many Minnesota locals, a cold winter is often just an excuse to get outside.
We have a bad reputation if you're not from Minnesota, but in Minnesota, we generally celebrate winter.
Kenny Blumenfeld is a senior climatologist with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. He says that winter recreation in the land of 10,000 lakes includes everything from skiing and ice skating to snowshoeing and ice fishing. These activities are possible because of the state's historically cold and snowy winters, which allow powdery snow to pile up and lakes to freeze over. But Minnesota's climate is warming, and winter is warming faster than any other season. Rising temperatures can cause lake ice to get thinner, making skating and ice fishing more dangerous. And Blumenfeld says that Minnesota is getting wetter, which means more snowfall. But the snow often melts mid-season and
the snow has a much higher water content, so it's heavy.
That makes it harder to ski on and more likely to damage trees and buildings. For people who love the snowy winters of the north, these changes can make climate change really hit home.
And I think it's that recreational piece that Minnesotans really feel, because that's where it hits them personally.
Flying a plane through windy, stormy conditions can cause a dangerous, turbulent ride. But a clear blue sky does not guarantee smooth cruising.
Clear air turbulence is completely invisible, as its name suggests, so it's nothing to do with flying through a storm. It comes out of the blue, often without warning.
And Paul Williams, a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Reading in the UK, says it's getting more common. He explains that clear air turbulence is caused by instability in the jet stream, which is increasing as the atmosphere warms. In a recent study, his team found that over the past 40 years, severe clear air turbulence over the North Atlantic increased by more than 50%. Scientists expect that this type of turbulence will grow even more common as global warming continues. Williams says people who fly do not need to be scared, but they should take precautions to stay safe.
It's really, really, really rare for someone seatbelted to be injured in a turbulence encounter. It almost never happens.
So whether the seatbelt sign is on or off, Williams recommends that travelers buckle up as flying gets bumpier in a warming world. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. People around the world come to Montana to enjoy big sky country.
People come here to hunt elk. They come here to fly fish. They come here to ski downhill. It's what makes Montana, Montana.
Frank Selasti is the executive director of the Montana Wildlife Federation. Outdoor recreation is an important part of Montana's economy. But the Wildlife Federation has released a report warning that many of these outdoor activities are threatened by climate change. Warmer water threatens cold water fish like trout and could lead to more restrictions on fishing. As winters get shorter and snowpack dwindles, fewer people may buy lift tickets to go skiing. And more wildfires may keep people from visiting national parks like Glacier or Yellowstone. The report cautions that by mid-century, these changes could cause Montana to lose thousands of outdoor recreation jobs and millions of dollars each year. So Selasi's group is advocating for climate action.
Our organization's been around for 87 years. We're motivated by a sense of intergenerational justice to ensure that 87 years from now, things that make Montana, Montana are still here.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Data scientist Hannah Ritchie joined in Climate Conversations just a couple of days ago. Well, not personally, but I did receive her book, which I'm about to read and try and make some judgments about it. On her website, Hannah says, "I'm a data scientist and science communicator. I focus on the largest problems that shape our world and how to solve them. Most of my work focuses on environmental sustainability, including climate change, energy, food and agriculture, biodiversity, air pollution and deforestation. I'm deputy editor and lead researcher at Our World in Data and a researcher at the Oxford Martin Program in Global Development at the University of Oxford. I'm looking forward to reading the book. The new book is called Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet." On her website, it says, "Feeling anxious, powerless, or confused about the future of our planet? This book will transform how you see our biggest environmental problems and how we can solve them." Hannah has been criticized by some, saying she'll become the darling of the climate deniers, as she is indicating through her writing that we can continue with life provided we make some minor tweaks here and there. I'll withhold my judgment until I finish the book. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. I apologise, it's rather short, but I need to get away because I need to go to Melbourne to listen to a conversation about diet and climate change. I'll report on that soon, and I've already got an agreement that I can speak with one of the people, or one of the speakers, Dr. Peter Johnston from the University of Melbourne, who understands diet and climate change. I'm looking forward to that. Well, thanks so much for your coming. It's been great to have you along. Now, don't forget to check out the show notes, as there'll be lots of links in there that I haven't been able to get to, but you read them, check them out, and make some decisions about where we go from here. Also, I urge you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. And beyond that, I'd love you to share this with your friends, because we all need to know all we possibly can about the climate crisis. Who's saying what? Who's not saying something? why they're not saying it, why they're saying things they should be saying, and what we can do about it. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now you take care and you stay safe.